said the general smiled, but didn't say any more than that. So when they got ready to leave, they shook hands. The general said, tell your father that I was just doing my duty and I'm glad it didn't work. So that's kind of an interesting postlude.
Mm-hmm. It seemed a very serious attempt, I suppose.
Well, the timing of it, as I recall, was at the noontime period when we normally were out there playing volleyball. And it looked as though what had happened was two men on a motorbike, one riding, the other sitting, heaved a hand grenade over, and their briefing must have described the volleyball court as so many steps or so many feet to the left of the driveway. It was actually to the right of the driveway, so it fell the right number of feet from the driveway, but in the wrong direction.
And what was the response when that happened? How did people in the compound, including yourself, react?
Emmett, do you have any recollection?
That happened just about a week before I got there. And then after I did my trip around the country and took over as chief staff, first thing I did was security inspection with a good Marine around the base and around the headquarters. It was appalled, and that's when I set up those guard posts and also put the guard at the top of the stairs in your living areas. And
security was very bad before you took over.
It was just, it was
waiting to happen.
Casual is a compliment, but we beefed it up considerably. And I'll give you some other things later.
One of your critics, I believe it was Shredley, suggested that your staff protected you from unpleasant facts. Would you comment on that?
Well, I tell you, anybody that would accuse Emmett Tidd of screening out bad news, this isn't no Emmett Tidd. To the best of my knowledge and belief, we knew as soon as it happened everything that shouldn't have happened, as well as the good things. Emmett, do you have anything to add?
I was appalled at that statement by Shredley because we kept encouraging you wanted to know the bad facts because you wanted to have a shot at the solution. And I know you have never greeted somebody bearing bad news with an ill-tempered response. Yeah. I just can't conceive of, he was way down the line talking to somebody who maybe had a chief petty officer that booted him in the fanny or something, but it wasn't.
In addition to the fact that Emmett was just absolutely incorruptible, either the flag secretary or the flag lieutenant was with me on these field trips and brought back notes on what the reports had been from the lower level guys who didn't hesitate to complain if they had a problem directly to me, even if their task force commander was not with me, so that there was nowhere in the system, as far as I could see, was anybody screening out the bad news. And there were one or two occasions when, as I mentioned yesterday, there were people that were not performing well, only one or two or three at the most, during my 20 months out there. And that was usually picked up very rapidly by the flag sec or flag lieutenant saying, hey, these guys are really bitching about this fellow. He doesn't know what he's doing. So I think we really had a system.
And there was generally a enlisted individual along with you, both as security and
to
mingle with the troops. Right. And that was the beginning, I think, of the command chief petty officer concept of communications that was able to get direct to him. But, the enlisted would have no reluctance in speaking to another enlisted. That was a good pipeline.
I just find that interesting when I read that, the difference between what that says and what everything else I've seen has said. I guess I'm trying to come to grips with how he was able to arrive at some of the conclusions.
Okay. Well, you'll be talking to other people too, and try it on them.
Okay. Looking back over your entire naval career, what was the greatest lesson or experience that you took with you from Vietnam?
The tremendous ingenuity and courage of young Americans, ability to improvise. We drew the broad outlines, and they fleshed out the picture. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we touched on yesterday that I came back with was a burning conviction that a lot had to be done to merit the trust and to reward these people. But here they were, volunteers to join the Navy, and volunteers again to come to Vietnam. They were double volunteers. And even the wounded weren't complaining about being out there. They were complaining about the kinds of things like not being allowed to have hard rock music in the clubs, not being permitted to have a beer in the barracks, not being able to have a neatly trimmed beard and mustache. The African Americans not being able to get beauty aid for their ethnic needs. More importantly, the fact that they were being discriminated against in housing by naval housing officers. All of these things, gave me the conviction that not only did the Navy have a terrible reenlistment problem that had to be dealt with, the lowest in history, 9.2%, but that they merited having these changes made. I felt like I was their representative of the enlisted guys out there in the war.
Do you feel that conclusion, after observing the conditions in Vietnam with the men, do you feel that more than anything else influenced your thinking as you went on to Washington to become CNO?
Yes, it did with regard to the personnel side. I had another whole range of concerns about the obsolescing nature of the fleet and the need to really begin to rebuild for the future at a time when we were fully committed to fighting a war. And then even with regard to the personnel changes, I felt the need to get a broader appraisal than just the Vietnam subset, which is why we set up this system of retention boards that we brought in each week, different cross-section of people. One week it would be bosun's mates from around the Navy, another week it would be black officers and their wives, another week it would be black enlisted and their wives, and various cross-cuts of combinations. And under this the skill of this very outstanding fellow David Halpern, who would sit and just help them focus on their gripes and complaints and recommendations. At the end of a week, they would come in and brief me and the Secretary of the Navy and my principal deputies on what it was that they were recommending. And so much of it coincided with what we had heard out in Vietnam anyway, that I felt reinforced. And I never had a calculation done, but I would estimate that at least 90% of the recommendations got implemented. At that time, Emmett was the implementer,
and we're green-striped. Right. I've explained to him how that played into the decision on the uniform change also. Then the survey came back only a 50-50, and you said, let's go for it, Dan, and we'll see.
Right. Did your time in Vietnam change your views about leadership? And if so, in what way?
I don't think it changed my views, because I had in my several commands practiced the philosophy that you had to make men want to follow, not drive them. And that to do that, you had to be in constant touch with every level. You had to encourage people to take you on if they didn't agree with your prospective decisions, and yet to understand that once a decision was made, then they would fall in line. I already had fought a couple of battles to try to deal with discrimination when I had command of Arnold J. Isbell. I had two Filipino stewards who desperately wanted to get into electrician ratings, and I had to personally fight the letter recommending that through each echelon to get it to the Bureau and get it done, because the prejudice was against doing that. And we got it done as an exception to the rule. So I had, you know, that sort of desire in mind even before I went to Vietnam. But I guess that I hadn't, in any of my commands, had wartime experience. The opportunity to see how our youngsters could perform in the war theater gave me even more confidence that, that we should take the risks of loosening the system up and trusting our men and letting them operate within less onerous rules.
Mod squad idea came out of that also.
Yeah, right. The knowledge that what responsibility could be achieved by people getting commands early really came out of our Vietnam experience. And mod squads were a great success, I think, even though the Navy did away with them after we.
Well, they largely integrated it to the extent of giving, of recognizing more often head and shoulders types that had had battle experience to more important jobs, but Admiral Holloway did not immediately do away with them. They had their good run, and it says, okay, we've proven it's true that they can't handle our responsibility, and many of them did get that.
I know that Admiral Paul Miller, who became a four-star admiral, was one of the mod squad skippers, and I think several others.
Wasn't Jerry Wages one of them, too?
Yes, he was.
And Dick Nicholson Dick was Nicholson. A squadron commander of Desron 26 that I had under my command when you let me go to sea for a whole 7 months.
That's right. He made admiral as a result.
Yes, sir.
Performance there.
I did my best, despite Jerry Miller. As did he.
Who determined the name Mod Squad? That sounds like the title of a television show. I'm certain this
it
had
was.
A more formal title.
Do you recall, was that
I
given by the guy?
I don't know if the press coined that or some of our people, but we said it ain't all bad.
Yeah.
It gets a message to the fleet.
Right.
We've had to take flack like that frequently from one side, but the Admiral's own family were good mirrors of what was the audience, the target audience. And if they approved it, we knew it would go.
Incidentally, Z-grams also were dubbed Z-grams by the sailors, weren't they?
Yes, sir.
We started the system of putting a Z in front of it, if it were one of those that I was personally pushing. And so the Z-grams were picked up by the sailors, and the press picked that up. And it turned out to be a useful appellation, too.
Right. And they gave us the term Mickey Mouse regulations. And finally, it was at Admiral Clary convinced you take that term
right.
out of the directive, and but the sailors knew what it was.
Well, from what I've read, there are harsher terms for those kinds of regulations.
Yes. There are.
If you've ever read Paul Fussell on World War II, the standard military term for demeaning regulations.
Chicken shit.
Yes, sir.
Forgive us, Moose.
When I immediately read, that was my immediate thought when I read the initial thing about Mickey Mouse regulations, is that this is probably being used in lieu of what is normally said by probably people in the service.
Right.
If we could shift gears a little bit, I would like to talk about, I suppose, what is the end game of your time in Vietnam, and that is the ACT UP program. Vietnamization.
Mm-hmm.
Given the political climate in the United States, this was probably inevitable. How soon after your arrival in Saigon did it become an issue, or was it an issue before you even went?
Going out, in the notes that I made to talk to the staff about, I jotted down that this comment that this was September of 1968, the election was going to be in November. Candidates were nominated, Nixon and Humphrey, that if Mr. Humphrey won, we were going to have a year, in my judgment, to turn over the fighting, and if Mr. Nixon were elected, we'd have probably 3 years, and that we therefore had to plan to turn it over in a year and stretch it out if in November Nixon were elected. And when did you arrive in?
I arrived in April, May, the first part of May of 69.
I forgot that it was that long that I had to suffer with the
show. It was almost a year after you've been here.
So I guess it was probably, it would have been in October, just a month after I got there, that we already put the outline of the plan together, because President Johnson sent for Abrams as he saw the candidacy of Humphrey going down the drain, and that was part of the reason that he was get that damn war over with, get those people out. So it was. Now I guess was Chick Brow there ahead of you?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. He was already
he was there, and he was the senior. He had not taken over. Paul Arbo was the senior naval advisor. Chick was working for you in some capacity, and would be the logical fleet up to chief of staff.
That's right.
And in regards to loyalty, and then I had orders to leave Paul Arbo.
Right. Okay. So I guess Chick had already, the Akhtov plan was primarily Chick's.
Right.
He was about, just as Dick Nicholson gets credit for the seafloat thing, Chick Rao is the one who conceptualized the business of Akhtov, and he leaned fairly heavily with regard to the cultural aspects of it on a cultural expert whose name I've forgotten.
But Chick had such a sense of that and empathy himself, and that's why he was a logical person to work directly with Commodore Chan.
It was pure Rao, and he located the building and had the concept. He understood that I had said, damn it, we're going to have to turn it over in a year if the wrong guy wins in November. So he had the plan ready to go, and then fortunately when Abrams came back, we were able to get right on it.
What was your thinking as the plant for Akhtov developed?
I always knew that it was going to be a very tough thing to do, but I believe that it was, given the fact that we had no choice, that it was the very best way to ensure that there was fighting potential on that perimeter of Cambodia and Parrot's Beak. And that since it was going to be for a long haul, unlike our own guys who only had a year's tour, we were going to have the kind of infrastructure that would support that, and that's what led to the PCR programs, pig, chicken, rabbits, and the building of the housing, the construction of bases that were more permanent in nature, so that the guys would have their families with them and have that much more reason to fight for what they were doing.
In a larger sense, given that the war had been, or had become, virtually an American war, what was your view of the overall climate, the political climate that led to the necessity of the indemnization?
It was worrisome as heck. We knew that we had a very tough mission to accomplish, and what we didn't know in the September-October timeframe of 1968 was whether it would be a year or 3 years, and I was guessing on the 3 years, and you couldn't tell the way public support was melting away, you know, whether even with Nixon being elected you'd have 3 years. So I worried about whether or not even our plan could be successful, but it certainly seemed like the very best way to prepare for the worst.
Mm-hmm. Would you characterize the turnover program as a greater challenge for you than interdicting the Viet Cong?
Yes, I think it was, because in the interdiction program, we were dealing with Americans, we knew the culture, there were no cultural problems, and we had experienced people. In the case of the Vietnamese Navy, we were expanding from about 8 or 10,000 to 40,000, and that meant just a tremendous number of inexperienced people that had to be quickly put in place, and we knew that one of the major differences in culture was that they thought in terms of family and village, not in terms of country and patriotism. So that you had a different challenge, and we knew also that whereas I had been able to free up the U.S. Navy from over-control by the U.S. Army, we knew we were going to have a real tough problem once the Vietnamese were running the war, keeping the Vietnamese Navy flexible enough to avoid being captured by the Vietnamese Army Corps commanders.
What are the arguments for and against Vietnamization at the time, from your view, or in Saigon?
I don't think that there was any argument against it at that level, because it was clear that that's what the national requirement was going to be. You know, indeed, Vietnamization was, the word Vietnamization, as I recall, check me on this, and you might want to check it to make sure we're both right, that it was after Mr. Nixon was elected and Mel Laird came to Vietnam and talked to General Abrams and me, that he went back and coined the word Vietnamization.
It was a bureaucratic coining of,
of what we were doing. And I'm not sure that I used the word Vietnamization until I heard Mel Laird play it back, but I talked in terms of having to turn the fighting over, and that was, it was clear even before Mr. Nixon enunciated as national policy that that's what we had to be ready to do. Is that responsive to your question, Les? If not, try me again.
Yes, sir, it is. I was just wondering what the political sense that you had of being in the position you were in, the responsibility that that placed on you.
I was fortunate in having those insights of being on the NHTSA farm every weekend and knowing what Johnson was thinking and what McNamara was thinking through Paul NHTSA and what he was thinking. And therefore, it was clear, and then as you look at the political debate, it was clear that no matter who won, we were committed to getting out. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it took a lot of brilliance to figure that we sure as heck had to be ready to move.
So that's an interesting point. It's an issue of the Americans are going to get out, win or lose.
That's right. That's right.
And how can you best do it?
Yeah. And there, you know, there were people, a lot of people who said, this ain't going to work. But nobody said, here's a better idea.
And the graduate students and others have brought up the point of, well, why didn't the commander of the naval forces resign if he saw this was impractical? There are a lot of people that said it was an impractical plan because they were working at the lower level and they were having difficulties with it. At higher levels, why didn't the Joint Chiefs of Staff resign? All of those old charges that we hear. Opposed to the view that if you quit, somebody else isn't going to do it as good, and I'll stay and fight it out. It's a question, you stay with the ship or you sink with it.
And I still believe that it would have worked had it not been for Watergate. Mm-hmm. If we could have continued to pound Hanoi every time they violated that truce, we'd have had a two Vietnam outcome.
Did you hear up the chain of command from the men in the field who were actually training for the turnover part of the operation? What characterizations, what experiences did you understand from up the chain of command that they had had?
We kept in close touch with the task force commanders, the swift boat commanders and the PDR commander and the Mobile Riverine commanders. You know, their evaluation was, this is tough, it's tough going, but it's going to work. They continued to work with their counterparts to make sure that as much of our martial tradition was passed on as possible. And I think Admiral Chan was himself confident that his Navy could carry the load if he were successful in preventing his army from breaking the mission up. You know. Mm-hmm.
that brings me to the next question, which is how did your relationship with Commodore Chan develop, and what was it like to work with him?
He was a joy to work with. We really became almost like brothers. I was always very careful, even though he was one star until just toward the end of my tour, and I was three stars. I always walked on his left when we were in the presence of Vietnamese Navy, which was increasingly almost everywhere we went. And when we had meetings with the Vietnamese personnel there, I always first asked him for his view. And if I didn't agree with it, I would usually just sort of say, well, that's an important point. Let's think about it, and then talk to him separately about it. I never overruled him in front of any of his people. He understood that that's what I was doing, and expressed over and over again privately that he appreciated the way in which I was handling it. He was very good about telling me where he thought we were doing things that were missing opportunities, and particularly his interest in the Nam Can Peninsula and his continual pointing out of the great resources there is what led us to make the presence down there that led to Sea Float. He was a great professional to work for. He had had lots of experience in fighting in those river areas when he was under the French Navy. Mm-hmm. And so he was a good source of professional wisdom with regard to riverboat operations. To my regret, when I left and Admiral Jerry King took over, who was not my choice, but who more insisted be nominated, Jerry King apparently took the other tack of trying to tell Chan instead of working with him. And I think that was an awkward situation for Chan. As soon as I was able to, I got Admiral Salzer out there to replace Admiral King, and he was very good about working with Chan in the right way. And then later, Admiral Price did the same.
That was one of your titles or roles, was it not? Was as senior advisor
to the Vietnamese Navy.
To the Vietnamese
Navy. Yeah.
That brings up an interesting distinction in my mind, because on the one hand, it seems that as COMNAV-4V, as the ACT-OFF program gets underway, it seems almost as if the United States is directing the entire mission, directing the training, directing the turnover dispersal of assets to the Vietnamese. But yet on the other hand, your official role is almost like you described as subordinate to Admiral Chan. Can you describe, did that relationship cause any difficulty, the distinction between those roles?
No, really, there were, as you say, two channels. General Abrams was the commander of the Military Assistance Command, as well as being the operational commander of U.S. forces. I was the senior naval advisor to the Vietnamese Navy, but I also was the naval component commander for operations. So I had the job of fighting the U.S. naval forces at the same time that I was advising the Vietnamese Navy. But as they began to integrate and become a single force,
right,
increasingly those two channels became one channel. And it could have been a very awkward thing, but Chan was so easy to work with and so philosophically understanding of what was required to have this melding process take place, that it was never, it was just never an issue there. And I believe it worked equally well at the staff levels, is it not?
Yes, sir, it did, and naturally by your influence, but it was because the guys were motivated by you. They wanted it to work, and it's the old saying, they do want to work as Chan and motivated his people, they found a way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think they were probably more tolerant than we were at the lower level at times. And our people did learn, though, quickly that they had to accommodate the cultural problem. Mm-hmm. And by your example of never upstaging, certainly not in public and in front of the counterparts, men, critical of an operation or a plan or something of that nature, there were mistakes and there were problems, and but by and large they worked them out.
Yeah.
Was Admiral Chaun ever involved in at the planning level for Act Of?
Yes. Yes, Chick Rao consulted with him from the very beginning. They had a very close relationship.
They sure did.
They were like brothers. To show you the nature of the thing, I'm sure this was after you were there, Emmett. One night we had a message that came out for U.S. eyes only that said there was going to be a coup attempt that night, and involving an attack on all military headquarters. And I just couldn't see not alerting Admiral Chaun to it, so we called Admiral Captain Rao in and said that this isn't supposed to be done, but go over and make sure that Chaun is aware and is alert. Well, when Chick got there and told Chaun, Chaun said, you know, I know all about it, and we're at maximum readiness. But he had tears in his eyes in appreciation for the fact that we had violated our orders to make sure that he was going to be ready, you know.
Touching.
Well, was there some concern that by informing the South Vietnamese, or any South Vietnamese of this, that you would violate some sort of intelligence?
Yeah, the concern was you never knew who the infiltrated Viet Cong agents were within the system. And as it turned out later, they were pretty high up in the system.
Mm-hmm. Or the coup plotters. Want to tip them off that you know it's coming if it's...
That's right.
At the time that you and Admiral Chaun are working together on Act Of, did either you or he at the time realize what Vietnamization was ultimately going to mean for South Vietnam?
Yes, I believe so. Which is why we felt collectively, both Chaun and I, that we had to have this infrastructure of houses and base perimeter defenses and pigs and chickens and rabbits, and that there had to be a system that was long-lasting if it were going to work.
Mm-hmm. The pigs and chickens, or the construction of the homes, did the chain of command that you worked through in order to implement this, did they regard this as necessary as you did, or were they more concerned about the actual war fighting aspects, the equipment, the technology?
Two comments. First, I think it's true to say that we violated almost every channel to get the resources. But I think also it's the case that the average American sailor out there loved the idea of doing that kind of thing for the Vietnamese. Instead of killing, he was doing something constructive, you know. And I think it was a real morale builder for our guys, don't you?
Yes, sir.
That we were embarked on that kind of a positive rather than negative work. Mm-hmm.
So you got a lot of positive feedback from
right
from up the chain of command based upon the program.
And we got a lot of unofficial help. We, as I recall, we had contributed a thoroughbred boar to breed to the sows. And a thoroughbred sow, and they named one of them Admiral Humboldt, one of them Admiral Chaun. I think I was the female one.
I won't comment on that. I'll neither confirm nor deny.
But it was a morale builder for both the Vietnamese and for the Americans.
An example of the way the Admiral supported that program, and I used some initiative in approving a priority to get those prize. Particularly the boar out there was later criticized, complained to the Admiral and Air Force General about this was, he denied the movement of a nuclear weapon with a priority like that, and Admiral somewhat had some comment to make, and he asked me about it, and I said yes, and he says, well, get as many of them out here as you can.
From higher up the chain of command, outside of Vietnam itself, was there any perception that a program like a pigs and chickens program was somehow beside the point, considering this is a war, or is there understanding outside of Vietnam that this is necessary?
There was understanding of that. We briefed Admiral Hyland when he came out about it, and he was a Sinclair fleet commander, Admiral Moore came out, and he liked the idea. General Abrams seemed to like it. They all understood that for the Vietnamese culture, you had to have the families with them, and you had to have long-term support. Mm-hmm.
So there was never a problem
getting
any of this approved or any of the logistics for it?
Right. Also brought in people like an Admiral John Hofer from the reserve and two or three other reserve officers, and had them go back and rally support from the civilian community for those things.
And then the foundation that he helped found for raising funds, which we were not permitted to do, and soliciting those funds, and the good use that was made of those, the tremendous support by the Fleet Reserve Association.
Right.
I mean, or a fleet, I guess that's what it's called, Fleet Reserve Association. They immediately came through the check for $10,000, while a lot of the other organizations wanted to have a cocktail party and discuss so forth. But this foundation then later led to direct procurement of those kind of prize stocks, as well as assistance with building programs and things that we were not permitted to fund. And there was a trust set up and a board of directors, so it was entirely legal.
And that was all sort of done quasi-officially. We didn't try to hide it, but we didn't ask for permission.
Tub has been criticized, and some of the sources I've read, as a political expedient. How do you respond to that?
Well, if by that it is meant that the politics of the nation were such that you had to get out of Vietnam, it was a political expedient. All military actions are the result of political decisions. If the military had had its way, as I said, we wouldn't have gotten in the first place. And if the military had its way, we wouldn't have gotten out so fast. But nevertheless, ACTOG, in my judgment, was a program that the requirement of political authority and had pacified the Delta, and could have continued to keep a pacified Delta had we not lost the war up north due to Watergate. Mm-hmm.
Was pacification in the Delta largely a result of the civil programs that you discussed, or were there other components to it?
It was the result of a combination of things. The pacification program by Cords had become increasingly effective. Ambassador Colby's work had led to the picking up of a very high percentage of the Viet Cong agents that had been seeded into the civilian population. Our perimeter defense of the Delta with the Sea Lords had cut the logistics support for any organized Viet Cong units down to a trickle. General Abrams credited that with making a major contribution to the pacification. And I would say the third component of it was bringing Vietnamese naval units forward with their families. Also helped give the civilian population the feeling that they had forward defenses. And collectively, I think those three programs led to a pacified Delta.
So as you develop ACTOB, as you are planning for the future, pacification then was a main thrust of everything that had to be planned.
That's right.
Okay. Do you feel, before, during, or after the ACTOB program, that the South Vietnamese Navy would be truly viable once the American influence and training and support had departed?
I did. The thing that was most worrisome was whether or not we could get their repair and maintenance capabilities up to the appropriate level. It took much longer to train people in their shipyard to replace our guys. But under the 3-year concept that we had, I felt that we could get that done. It was always realized that we were going to have to provide some logistic support, part of the final commitment that President Nixon made to President Tu was that we would continue replacement of their equipment and provide logistic support, and that we would retaliate viciously in the event of a truce violation. So, with the understanding that we were never just going to sever all ties, but let them do the fighting and provide the logistic muscle, I think the program was viable.
What was your feeling regarding, not the South Vietnamese maybe, but South Vietnam as a whole? What was your feeling regarding the future of South Vietnam when you departed for Washington?
I felt reasonably comfortable. President Tu had achieved a situation in which the perennial coups had ceased. He had established the beginnings of a democratic system. He and General Ki, who had originally been senior in the dictatorship, had worked out an MO in which they were working together as president and vice president. The chairman of their joint general staff, General Nguyen, was a competent person. They increasingly were weeding out the corrupt and the incompetent, and there was increasingly a higher and higher percentage of really professional people. And so I felt that the overall system was going to work.
Inside the system, just your perception of South Vietnam itself, Saigon, the people, of the atmosphere around the area during the time you were there when you left, how would that compare with how you regarded the South Vietnamese Navy or the South Vietnamese government?
I was more confident of the Navy than I was of the Army. I felt a high degree of confidence in the Air Force. I still felt that the Army was competent. I felt that as you looked at the general population, that the entrepreneurship in the case of the Vietnamese was such that if we created a stable balance in the South, that over time the same economic miracle that took place in the two Koreas would take place, that the South would go way up and the North would deteriorate. Mm-hmm. And I was confident that the South Vietnamese had that entrepreneurial spirit.
Did you feel while you were there that the South Vietnamese had a positive or a negative view of Americans or the American military, and could you describe your sense of that?
I felt that there was great respect by the Vietnamese for the American military. When I had lunch one time with General Nguyen, he told me that one of the things that was hardest for them to understand was that we Americans, the generals and the admirals, had our sons out there fighting with us. General Abrams had three sons out there. I had two. Jim and the Marines offshore, and Elmo in the theater. And he said in Vietnam, almost every general officer has his son in Europe going to school. They couldn't understand why high-ranking people in our system, and admired the fact that high-ranking people in our system didn't try to use their authority in the ways that they would use theirs. That was a cultural difference.
What was your view overall, just to get a general sense of your experience in Vietnam, what was your view of Vietnamese cultures compared to American culture, and what bearing did that have on your working with the South Vietnamese?
As I mentioned earlier, it was clear that at the village level, or even at the city level, you didn't see the same feeling of nationality, of nationhood, that we have in America. And therefore, a villager whose son got drafted to go into the armed services didn't have at least the comfort that an American parent has of knowing this fellow is doing his duty as a national patriot. And so it was. We always realized that one of the continuing chores was going to be to build that nationhood, But the same thing was true of South Korea by the end of the Korean War, and we had seen that miracle put across of a nationhood emerging. And so I was confident that in the long haul we'd get that in South Vietnam. That was the primary cultural difference that struck me. The other thing that was perfectly understandable and natural was that it's a different mindset when you get sent, as our sailors and soldiers were, for what they knew was going to be a year's fighting experience. Whereas the Vietnamese soldier or sailor had to think in terms of 5, 10, 15, or maybe even 20 years. Many of them had already fought for 20
years. Duration.
That's right. So that that clearly gives you a different mindset about how much risk you're prepared to take and so forth.
Well, that raises an interesting point. One of the most criticized aspects of the American aspect of the Vietnam War, it was the 12-month rotation. What is your view of that? Did that have an effect on the way that the American soldiers fought the war and or the outcome of the American effort there?
It's clear that the year's tour meant that you, on the average, had a less efficient fighting force than you would have had with 2 or 3 year tours, because a new man coming in took 2 or 3 months to get oriented, and then toward the end of his tour, he got a little gun-shy about am I going to be unlucky enough to lose my life on the last day, as happened in some cases. So we would have had a more efficient fighting force if we could have gone 2 years, and it would have been still more efficient if we could have gone 3 years. I think 3 years is probably about as long as you could maintain morale, but you did lose as a result of that